Today's episode is brought to you by Belulu Studios. Belulu Studios is a small event space located at 3131 Bull Street in Savannah, Georgia. For more information, visit belulustudios.com/eventspace. That's B-U-L-U-L-U studios.com/eventspace. Hello, this is Kevin. Thank you for listening to The 10 Frame. Recently, Kelly and I were able to meet up with artists who are living and working in Augusta, Georgia. We have affectionately titled this four-part series, The Augusta Files. This includes interviews with Matt Porter, Edward Rice, Chadwick Tully, and Franklin Delgado. This conversation is the second episode within this series, and it is a special one for me because of the subject matter. Kelly and I have interviewed many painters, but Edward Rice uses oil paint to masterfully render images of buildings. His paintings are available at a few galleries in South Carolina, Arkansas, and Georgia. Learn more about Edward's work online at edwardriceart.com. Follow Kelly and I on Instagram at The10Frame, at Kelly K. Thompson Art, and at Kevin Will Paint. As I mentioned, it's a great honor to speak with you. I know your work through online, and unfortunately I haven't been able to see it in person, but thank you for letting us come into your studio, and I look forward to listening to you talk about a little bit about your work.
Glad to have you here.
Right on. So I mentioned I did see you online. What are those venues? Do you have a website or Instagram?
I do have a website, edwardriceart.com.
So I'm an architectural designer, and I went to school for architecture down in Miami. And so I have a keen interest of what you're up to. Can you maybe describe what you do in the mediums?
Sure. I'm a painter. I'm 71 years old. I've been doing it for a living since I was 21, so quite a long time. But as a child, architecture was the only real art that I saw. Because growing up, did not see paintings, did not go to plays, did not go to symphonies, did not go to poetry readings. But my parents would take us to Charleston, and I went to New York City and to New Orleans. And I recall being, 6 and 7, 8 years old, just being enthralled with architecture. And I often get the question, Ed, why are you not an architect? Well, my brother is, so he does it.
Nice.
And plus, in the 70s, when I was coming up, hate to say, I didn't like what was being done in architecture. All the cold, brutalist stuff just didn't appeal to me. Plus, being in my early 20s, it was just a way to make a living. This is too much information, but
when I was
14, most boys, we made our pocket money by cutting grass. We get $5 per yard.
Wow.
Where I got the idea, I don't know, but I thought one yard I was doing, I brought my sketchbook, and I said, you know what, would you like a drawing of your house for $5? Not really, but...
go cut my grass.
Go ahead. So I said, this is a lot better than cutting grass. Yeah. So I started doing these sketches around the neighborhood. The next summer, I doubled my prices. Now it's $10. $10 for an Ed Rice drawing of your house. That's where I started, just a provincial picture maker, not knowing a thing about anything. So I tried to just go forward, learn, and...
Do you still have those drawings?
I'll show you one. There's one drawn when I was 16. Looks like the work of a 10-year-old. It is pitiful. It is so pitiful. I did take drawing lessons when I was 6 years old from the daughter of the founder of our town. It's like a William Faulkner set up, the grand Greek Revival house with all the sideboards and the silver. And my art teacher was very impoverished. Her sole income was teaching neighborhood kids art. That was my background. And then, of course, I majored in art in college, and I met my mentor, Freeman Schoolcraft, was a well-known sculptor in Chicago in the 20s and 30s. He married an Augusta girl up in Chicago, and he retired to Augusta in the 60s. And I met him and studied with him. We went. Then I married his daughter. That's an old trick. You marry the daughter of your master. Then we spent a summer in Europe and a summer in Santa Fe, and I started going to museums and just seeing real art. And often get the
Santa
question,
Fe, New Mexico, right?
Yeah, yeah. I often get the question, Ed, when did you decide to be an artist? I never made that decision. Never. I just did it. Mm-hmm. I was a provincial picture maker. Got married when I was 21. By then, I was doing little watercolors of houses, like for $200, and then $400. And you have to remember, though, at that time, it was so cheap to live. We had a charming cottage with a big room in the big house next door, all for $100 a month.
Wow!
And no credit card debt.
No cell phones.
No cell phone.
No Instagram.
No, I would just. I lived very well. I lived like a king for nothing.
May I ask?
Sure.
I was jokingly saying that about the technology. So
yeah.
You're an artist your whole life. What was your ways of communicating and getting your work out there maybe back in the day?
Yeah, important question because especially when I started, Augusta, Georgia and North Augusta, limited opportunities for a professional because a professional, you leave this town to further your career. Well, my goal, I wanted to live in a small town and make a living from my work. And the consensus was, can't be done. Can't be done here. So I sort of used the Greeks as my paradigm. You go out. So I early on had a dealer in Santa Fe. The South Carolina Arts Commission was very supportive of an independent painter. So I'd go to Columbia, introduce myself. I'd wear my seersucker suit and my wingtip shoes and shake people's hands. And
true Southern gentleman.
And I would introduce myself to galleries, and I started entering competitions. There was one called Artist in Georgia. And every 2 years, it would be at the High Museum 1 year, or the Georgia Museum of Art the next year. I was in one of those, and I was contacted by quite a few Atlanta galleries, so I started showing at Heath Gallery. One contact leads to another. Right now, I have...
It was all kind of word of mouth.
Yeah, it's word of mouth. And now I have, I think, 6 dealers that handle my work.
Nice.
And but the key was moving out from where I live and using my studio and my home as a base. But I used to travel an awful lot, and I still do, but I don't like to travel. I like staying right here.
What were some of those spaces that you liked to go visit? Or was it for business or both, maybe?
Well, in my late 20s, the mantra was two words that were like the Holy Grail, New York. If you're a serious artist, you have to make contacts there. And I was in a couple of shows, group shows in New York years ago, but now it's unimportant to me. And so I go to New York and go to all the galleries, but I always prefer the museums. I like the National Gallery, Washington, the National Gallery, London, the great museums of Paris. If I had to pick one museum, probably be the Prado. I went there when I was 21 and went back at 68, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And it's great seeing work that you saw as a young man, and then see the same work as an old man. Different perspective, but great art is timeless and inexhaustible. And obviously, one would hope that I would see more in the painting at 71 as I did at 21.
Were you always making oil paintings back then? You mentioned drawing, but when was that transition into oil painting?
I was about 22. Well, I started in college. How old are you in college? 19?
Something like that.
Yeah, I started when I was 19.
Yeah.
And my teacher was a sculptor by profession, but when he painted old school. That's one reason my work is so old-fashioned looking. I use basically a pre-modern technique where I start with an elaborate measured pencil drawing, just measured like a carpenter. Then I do the whole composition in monochrome. So I establish the tones. Then I let the monochrome underpainting dry, then glaze over it with many layers of color, and it gives a depth of surface one cannot achieve with one layer of paint. Plus, I'm not smart enough to do it in one layer. I'm not, you know, Van Gogh could just look at something and shape, tone, color, texture, all in one. That's like a work of genius. I have to break it down one step at a time. That's what I do.
Yeah. I'm interested in, you talk about the underpainting.
Yeah.
And that's something that I try to establish up front with my work as well. Do you have a go-to? I see some warm grays. Is that, do you normally use like a similar underpainting with all of your work?
I do. It's almost always a raw umber, which is traditional. Two reasons. Technically, it's a fast dryer. You want a fast dryer as for an underpainting. And I like that warmth showing through. Like if I do a blue sky, it'll have a warm brownish tone subtly showing through, and it gives a depth that you can't achieve just by having blue on a white canvas. And umber, I believe it's from the Latin for shade, and it's strange that it's been used for shading for hundreds of years. And I learned a lot just by looking at unfinished paintings. You look at unfinished Goya or an El Greco, you can see plain as day how they would lay in the browns first. And same with John Constable. I tend to look mainly at art of the past. I'm fairly uninformed on the current state of things. I do make a stab at it now and then, but I'm more up on art of the past.
Are there any current artists that you do look towards to as either inspiration or as having commonalities?
Yeah, I like Peter Doig. I saw a huge thing of Peter Doig's in Dublin last year. But I made a joke. I first saw his work years and years and years ago. And I told someone, I'm going to quit being a painter and be a talent spotter. I saw a show years ago, and there was an artist, pretty unknown, Peter Doig. I said, man, that guy's good. Oh, it was for sale too, for not a lot. I should have bought it and got some investors and kept it, like the people do that collect art.
That's like us who should have bought America Online stock back in the day, right?
Yeah.
I love his work. If I'm not mistaken, he's based in one of the islands, isn't he?
I think Trinidad.
Trinidad, yeah.
Yeah, because it's hard to be a representational painter. And you know, the catchwords today are relevant, compelling, or the key word, empowering. His work is certainly compelling. Another painter I've admired for years, deceased now, Lucian Freud. And someone, I like Lucian Freud's comment when someone asked him, Lucian Freud, what do you ask of a painting? I ask it to be, let me see if my memory's going to fail me now. I'll come back to it.
Okay. All right. We can fit it in there. I wanted to ask as well, as I have a graphic design background, and when I look at your work, there's a graphic quality to it in that your interplay between contrasting elements is kind of the looks like the scaffolding of the actual piece itself. Yeah. Do you look to maybe works from the 20s and 30s in graphic design that seems like, if I wasn't familiar with your work, that would be something, a connection that I would draw.
Correct. I'll get back to that. I just saw the three.
Sure.
To astound, to disturb, to convince. Like when I look at my work, is it astounding? No. Disturbing? No. Convincing? I hope so. Convinced of something like, hey, I think this guy cares about what he's doing here. But I'm very influenced by the painters of the 20s and 30s, Schiller, and I like the Art Deco period, and the architecture, the industrial design, the automobiles, the locomotives, you know, a refrigerator, whatever it is.
Mm. Raymond Loewy.
Sure, that's the man, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Stephen Brooke?
I'm drawing a blank.
He's a photographer, architectural photographer.
Okay.
I know that he teaches some, or he used to teach some classes at the University of Miami, but he looked at buildings from such a beautiful perspective in terms of like day, you can pick the daytime, the brightness or the heat of the sun shining and all these different moods. And he would sit with a building for however long it took for him to get an understanding of when that light is magically placed on that building.
Okay, not to be overly agreeable, but that's exactly what I do. And if you name like the top architectural photographers of today, I wouldn't know them. I'm in the dark about that.
Yeah.
But when I decide to depict something, it's more about the light on the building itself. Like the piece I'm doing here, I've driven by it for 50 years, and when I decide to depict it, I don't go at 8, but I go at maybe 8:30, 10:30, 11:30, 1:30, 2:30, 4, all through the day. And the shapes that the light and shadow make. And when it's right, I know it. When it's not right, I know that too. And if it's never right, I won't depict it, because it's not really about the building so much. So this piece, 11:45.
Yeah, and if the light isn't right now, but you really love the building, you might check it back in a couple of months, or maybe the winter time.
Exactly, because it's totally different. As you know, obviously, 11 o'clock dead winter is different from 11 o'clock in August.
Yeah.
So the way the sun and the earth and all the planets move in space, it's all part of the equation.
Do you have a specific style? Do you have a specific day or month or hour that you're... I know it's all site-specific. I would imagine it's site-specific, but...
Yeah, I prefer a winter light. There's less humidity in the air, and I like the deep blue skies in the afternoon, kind of a worn-out phrase, but the light is golden. What does that mean, it's golden? Well, it's very warm. And in the summer, especially around here, you have the dog days where the sky is white and the distance is gray, and it's 1,000 degrees. But that's a challenge, too. It's a painting. I know you can't see this, but that's an attempt to paint August. It's a beach house down at Edisto Island.
It feels like the morning time on that, or late evening.
It's a morning light, but I try to get a sense of the humidity and...
It's so gentle.
The heat. I try to make my paintings quiet. I think they are quiet.
That's a good word, yeah.
They're not big, loud, rude, and crude. Some would say, well, our world is big, loud, rude, and crude, and art should reflect the reality of what's going on in the world. There are many that do that. I just do the quiet stuff.
I think you need a respite from that insanity and the loudness. There's definitely a calm in there, but you also get the feeling of the time and place. The atmosphere that you're describing and the light, that's even just seeing the little piece of that I can see, it's very evident. And you kind of almost feel like you're present.
Well, thank you. That's a goal. But as you see, that this place is quiet. I play a Gregorian chant in the morning. In the afternoon, I might play some old blues, but I like contemplative, quiet music. The phone doesn't ring over here, and it's really like a sanctuary, but perhaps that's what a studio should be.
What medium do you use to listen to the music?
$50 boombox.
Yeah. So is it radio, or do you enjoy cassettes or discs?
Old CDs.
Right on.
That's what I have, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
That's great. What are some of the blues musicians that you like?
Blind Willie, as a coincidence, he's from around here. He's from Thompson, Georgia. And I like his work from the 20s and 30s. There's an authentic nature to it, because it is authentic.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard of Marcus King?
Heard of him, yes.
Younger guy.
Yeah.
Slays at the guitar, electric guitar.
Okay, yeah.
Blues.
Yeah.
We were talking about your observations with the light and trying to view your architecture or the building in at different times of the day. When you come back to the studio, how do you remember that? Do you work from photographs, or do you sketch while you're there and work from those?
Yeah. I used to do a lot of work on the site. Not anymore. When I'm in Ireland, I do small landscapes on the site, kind of, you know, pokey little landscapes. But I don't work on the site over here at all anymore. I'll show you some earlier work. They were done. I would do the drawing in the studio and do all the painting on the site, and it does give a completely different, it's a different world when you paint on the site. But what I do, I'll take a photograph once I decide 1145 is the light pattern, and that will just give me the general shapes that I can lay the composition out with my T-square and rulers. But the color is just from memory, and I'll, like a Monday morning, I'll ride over at 1145 and look at it, drive straight back to the studio, and start laying in the color, because, you know, one cannot rely on the color from a photograph to paint from. But a photograph is a photograph. It has its own strengths, but a painting is a painting, and two different things. So I get... answer your question, the color comes from memory. Then at a certain point, the painting has its own direction. And my mentor used to always tell me, the painting will tell you what it needs. It's not always about observation. I start with observation, but in the end, it'll go off to slightly somewhere else where I think the piece needs to be to make it live. Otherwise, you have like a dead piece on the canvas. So it's hard to describe these things, but that's sort of the idea.
More intuitive process, yeah. when you start working, yeah, with the light and the, yeah, feel, yeah, of the piece.
Yeah, I start with direct observation, and eventually it becomes more intuitive.
So that process seems like it would work well if you're doing an architectural piece that's close by. What about if you're doing a house that's in Ireland or in Washington, yeah, D.C. Yeah. I mean, are there just more preparative sketches and color renderings?
Yeah. Essentially, I do not depict anything outside the U.S. when I'm over here. I just do all the Irish stuff in Ireland. But that London piece, one reason I chose to do it in black and white is a warm black. Of course, the actual building is stone, a gray stone, but there's a multitude, an infinite amount of subtle colors in stone. And I told myself, I could never do that not being there. So I will just do the whole thing in monochrome as a complete piece. So I guess that answers the question. If someone said, oh, we just bought a house in France, could you do a painting of that for us? I would say, sorry, can't do it. No.
It's hard to... go there and look at the light and then rush back to the studio.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
You say, well, if you want to provide me a studio and, yeah, set it up, then...
Sure. And it's hard for non-painters to sort of understand that. Can't you work from a good photograph? No, I can't.
that may be a starting point, like you said. You're laying out the grid.
I have questions about the tools.
Yeah.
So we're sitting in your studio. It's... a beautiful space with vaulted ceilings and skylights and, you know, many dozens of brushes and glass jars. And then I'm also seeing tools that are familiar to me in my day job, which is an architectural office, which is obvious, you know, why wouldn't you use that? But because your work, it seems so realistic and honest and genuine. And are they to scale? I'm looking at architectural rulers and T-squares, and do you paint to scale, or is it just to get you in the world of that?
Well, it gets me in the world of exactitude. I'll just decide on a format, you know, square, horizontal, or vertical, and then a scale, 6 feet square or 30 inches square, and then
like you look for header heights, yeah, right? This is going to be my 6'8" or,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I do. And then, yeah, I just use the architectural rulers. I don't go below a 32nd of an inch. That's as small as I'll go laying out a composition.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but they're reasonably exact.
That's interesting. So even you mentioned composition, even your placement on you're not referencing photographs, right?
No. When I'm laying the composition out, and it's hard to, I always think there's maybe this a false belief, but there's something holding in the numbers. So like when it's 30 by 30, okay, I want the roof at 6 inches, and I want this down. I want each element to relate to the canvas. So that's how I think one can achieve a sense of rightness, because it's carefully composed like a building, like a good piece of furniture, like a good chair or a good song, whatever. It's structured and designed.
Yeah, I feel it, definitely.
One of the observations that I made in looking at a lot of your pieces were there's a focus on the top of the roof line, yeah, where it's pointed up.
Yeah.
So there's kind of an uplifting.
Yeah.
It's not just horizontal and vertical lines. There's, yeah, some sort of directive up. Is that intentional?
It's intentional. I like looking up. It's something Edward Hopper said, there's something about light on a house. It sounds very simplistic, but there's something about a cupola against the sky, the man-made against the non-man-made, and the infinite nature of the sky with the constructed world of man. And another aspect I like about looking up, often street level will change over the decades, but when you look up at the top of the building, you don't really know what year is being depicted. Like this structure, obviously it's like an 1880s building, but am I depicting it in 1980 or 1880 or 2021? You don't really know. That's what I like about not showing the foreground.
Or vehicles.
Yeah, yeah. So I like looking at the top. And plus, just a sense of, when I was a teenager, I would do these small drawings of an entire house. I don't like the sense of scale, to use the word. I like to take a smaller element than this, like a dormer window or a cupola, and doing that about 4 feet tall. So the forms are not so small. I like to get a sense of the monumental. And it's not always just how big something is. It's how it relates to the canvas. So have a bigger shape on a canvas rather than having a house with 16 windows. Do one window and do it big. And also, I like Georgia O'Keeffe's work. She did a painting of a window. I think it's up at Lake George. But before her Santa Fe period, I liked her New York paintings of New York City, mm-hmm, and her Lake George paintings, where she would really focus on an element and have it, I hate to use this word, but have it simplified to sort of elemental shapes.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I've said it a couple of times, but I went to school about 15 years ago, and it was all computers.
Yeah.
And my entry into the design world and the professional world was through Photoshop. So I would take digital images of buildings that, yeah, were generated or created by architects, essentially, and they would ask me to render them.
Yeah.
And so I had my toolbox of brushes, and the approach that you're making the work to, there's parallels, but it's just, it's so foreign to me, yeah, but it's so not, because it's so real. I don't know if I'm explaining.
You are, yeah.
The just before me was people drawing, you know, with Prismacolors, these renderings, yeah, for client meetings and things, yeah, like that. They were Prismacolors or water color pencils. But it's special being here. It's interesting to see all of your work.
It is kind of old school, but I often think, you know, maybe I should learn about this thing called Photoshop. So
please.
Well, I read John Curran does a lot of his preliminary work before he starts to paint. He does it on Photoshop. You're finding a particular model then redesigning it to your own specifications and using that as maybe a starting point. But I've never tried Photoshop.
No. Yeah, I'm not saying it to encourage you.
No.
I'm saying it because I was often trying to be as authentic as I could.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can't really do that with a mouse and then or a Wacom, like a tablet. But
just thinking about that, one element of Photoshop I think that people like to use when, you know, prefacing a painting is being able to maneuver the composition and, you know, where, especially if you're doing details on architecture.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a great tool.
Yeah, but I think it's so intuitive to you, and you've where you already know what composition is going to work, as opposed to somebody who has to be playing around with it. Is it hard to figure out how you want everything placed and cropped? Because I can see just a shift one way or the other can change the entire painting.
Exactly, but usually I know exactly what I want to do or I don't do it. I'll see something, I'll say, yeah, out on the street somewhere, I'll say, yeah, square format, 3 feet by 3 feet, center here, and I'll see the whole composition in my mind's eye. That's how I start.
That's what I was going to ask. You kind of have that idea in your mind's eye.
I'll do this, you know.
Right.
And, yeah. To decide vertical, horizontal, or square, and then the size of the thing. A lot of the painters now, they'll paint, 18 by 36 feet. I'm not set up for that. But
I was curious about the scale, if you ever did like one-to-one or anything.
Yeah. I did one piece up 6 feet tall, just a life-size depiction.
Doorway or?
Yeah. Well, this is life-size too, the London thing.
Yeah.
And it's quite a challenge because, this is an overused word, but it feels so real when a measure of molding, okay, it's four inches across. Okay, make it 4 inches. And when I do full scale, I'll just take my measuring tape down to the building and measure things and write down what it is and then start from there.
Yeah.
Can you just explain to people that aren't familiar with your work or probably haven't seen this yet online?
Yeah.
The piece, the London piece, the full size, it's hard to get a mental picture of what it is. It almost looks like it's a man's face.
Yeah.
But it's a piece of stone. It looks like maybe the top of a pillar, or at least part of a frieze.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a Greek god or I can't really tell who it may be, but you said it's life size. Well, life size for that piece it looks like it's about 5 feet tall.
5.5 feet tall.
Five and a half. Yeah. Can you just describe, when you saw it, is it way up in the air?
Yeah.
I mean, how
I'll make a stab at it.
Sure.
Because I have one friend now deceased who was blinded as a child. So he died at age 80 a while back. But he said, Ed, I had sight as a child. So if you describe something, I can see it. So it's a great challenge. He would come to the studio and say, what are you working with? Describe it to me. Quite a lesson to describe with words what you're looking at. The painting I will describe now, it's called River God. It's 5.5 feet tall, depicting a classical motif from a detail of a building in London called Somerset House. Now, Somerset House is not a house at all. It's built... started in the late 1790s by one of my favorite architects, William Chambers, was the eminent architect of the day. And a Somerset House, it's like two city blocks long and a block deep, and it's right on the river. And originally housed the Royal Academy of Art. So all the great shows that Turner would be in and Constable were at this building. It also housed the offices of the Royal Navy and other learned societies. Today, you wouldn't have the military and the arts in the same building. No way. So it's a very impressive building, originally built right on the water. And there's a gigantic arch where the royal barge, and when you say barge, you think of a primitive structure. Now, these were very elegant water crafts, like a giant gondola with maybe 12 rowers, and the front would be gilded. So the Lord Mayor would come by water through the Great Arch. Nelson would come through the Great Arch. In the late 19th century, kind of a long story, but it must be told. The river was very polluted. So London built what's called the Victorian Embankment. They built a road out about 50 feet out into the water and then down with a giant promenade on top. Underneath was the vast sewer system of late Victorian London. So now the building is cut off from the river, and it's been raised up about maybe 30 feet. So walking by, the keystone over the Great River Arch is only about 8 feet overhead. So in the past, I'd have to get in a boat and go out to the water and look across at it. But now you can walk right up. It's like, this is right there. And it's monumental. It depicts Father Thames, as in T-H-A-M-E-S, the river god. So he's a fertility figure, and he has a fruit in his hair. I have no idea what the things on his ears are. Look at those kind of like shells. And his beard represents the current and eddies of the water. So it's a very symbolic figure, Father Thames. And the cartoons of the day showed him very bedraggled from the pollution of the river. But that's the story, classical motif. As I mentioned, my mentor was a stone carver, so I like the way, putting aside the river god face, just the architecture itself, deliberately leaving the vertical chisel marks as texture on the building, and the way the molding is designed.
What time of day was that?
You know, I should answer that, shouldn't I? I think it was about 1 in the afternoon.
That's got a very, the raking light,
yeah,
kind of accentuates.
Another challenge, too, all the like coral and all kind of stuff on top of the head is quite eroded over time by rain and, I hope not acid rain, but some of the forms were so worn away, I could not tell exactly what they are. So that's a challenge, too. You just look at the shape. You don't have to know what it is. Look at what is the light doing? What is the shadow doing? What is the reflected light doing? So that was a challenge. Plus, doing the giant classical head, no straight lines. That was, I hate to say fun, but just going like this, which I never do when the architectural...
Making swirly shapes.
Yeah, come on.
Figure eights.
Yeah, like that beard.
The swirly shapes of the beard.
That painting is, I think, 15 years old now. I would say it's a little overly illustrative, and it's kind of lacking in atmosphere, but it is what it is.
It's very strong. It has a strong presence.
Oh, thank
but
you.
I also see in the stylistic nature of the carving, things that Leonardo would do, because he actually took the idea of eddies and currents, and he would stylize hair the same way.
Very much so. He would see the force of nature and the hair or the water or a tree branch, but with the way a bird's wing would move in the sky. It's all related. Power of Mother Nature and Father Time.
What's the substrate for this painting and maybe some of the common substrates that you paint on?
Linen canvas.
All of them? Most of them?
Yeah.
Right.
And I get the stretcher, of course, that's the wooden frame that the canvas is stretched on. I have those made in Canada, and I like Belgian linen, and often I will use mainly pre-primed, but back in the day I would use the rabbit skin glue as a sizing, and then put two coats of lead white that has to dry a year before you paint on it. I've done that in the past, not so much anymore. I use like oil primed linen.
Okay.
So I see this, the small squares behind you.
Yeah.
Is that wood? Wood panels primed with umber?
Yeah. For small pieces, I prefer a panel. And I take those to Ireland. Two reasons. I think a small piece is, 8 by 10 inches. It's best on panel. And they're much easier to travel with than small canvases, but you can't poke a hole in it. So I pack those in my suitcase. And I'll take 12 over and bring 12 back. So that's getting ready for the summer.
Beautiful. You're heading over at the beginning or at the end?
Mid-June. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, when we take the train up to Edinburgh, we'll wave as we come by.
Wave, yep. I'm down on the southwest coast, and I only have that privilege because my wife is Irish, and she's the eldest of 11, and they're all still there. They're all still in Ireland. So it's a family thing.
What part of Ireland did you say? It's on the on the west coast?
Yeah, County Cork.
County Cork.
We're on the southwest part of County Cork. Beautiful place to be.
So what, as far as shows are concerned or things coming up in your near future, aside from the travel, are there other things that we can kind of get out there?
Well, I'll say this. Getting past 70, It is food for thought, because I read somewhere we only have so many decades and it's all over. Really? I never knew. But I'm really want to focus on doing the kind of work I want to do. Aren't you doing that now? Well, yeah, but I want to do something better. And some say, that's delusional, Ed. You'll never be better than you are now. Come on, you've done it. No. You know, hope springs eternal. So I hope to do better work and maybe something different. I'm thinking about taking maybe a year off from architectural stuff and doing this big figures, maybe 6 feet tall.
That sounds exciting.
So that's what I like about being older. I really don't, submit to competitions anymore, or I'm not so concerned about exhibitions. I just want to do the work and work with my dealers, and that's what I do.
Sounds like a great place to be.
Well, I'm very fortunate to be here, but it only took 50 years.
Is that it? So I'll be about 107 when my time rolls around.
I noticed, I'm looking at a music stand, and I think behind me is a guitar.
Yeah.
Do you play music?
In the privacy of my own home.
Yeah.
But I did music professionally when I was like 18 and 19.
Six string acoustic.
Six string acoustic, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one reason you said about the mic. Takes me back.
Oh, I get you.
We had, before you plugged in, like they do now, we had one mic on the voice, one mic on the guitar. So you had to really
be intentional.
Stay on it, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think this might be a good place to wrap it up. Yeah, I appreciate it.
I just want to say, honored to have you here. It's always nice when someone takes interest in what you do. It's much appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for letting us do this in your studio as well, because this, a lot of times we're in a gallery space or in a place where we can only see something as a backdrop, but being in the space and feeling the energy of the place,
it's special.
Really is special for us.
Thanks. Yeah. That's what I hope. So we can meet downtown, but why not meet here where I am?
No,
so,
this is beautiful.
We like this. It's great.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.